fellow alcoholics and friends. My name is Alabama Carruthers, and I'm a grateful, happy alcoholic. It's good to be here. I'd like to thank the committee for inviting me, but I'd like to also tell you it's good to be anywhere. It's good to be alive. It's good to be where I was invited to come, you know, and get me on the same day I was invited. And the best part of all of it, I don't know where I've been when I get home. I don't know about you, but it was that's a switch for adults like me. I've been 34 years sober, approximately December the 1st. I was so sick that nobody thought about writing down the date because they didn't know whether I was going to live or not. But they know when they gave me the last drink. And I'm impressed. I really am impressed. I'm impressed what God and Alcoholics Anonymous could do for me that I could not do for myself. I give God the credit, but I hope that I never forget to be impressed that what happened in my life that made it possible for me to stay sober. I love Texas. If they run me out of California, I'm going to come and live with you. I feel so at home every time I come into Texas, and that's often. If you're new and you're a young lady, I think maybe it might bother some of the gentlemen. I thought I was a moral leper when I came to AA. And I think the best news that I had was that I was a sick woman and not a bad woman. And I was here to get well and not to get good. And you know it happened. And I think it's great because I'm an Episcopalian, sir. Lived over in Boulder City, Nevada, and my drinking and gambling was pretty heavy. And I politicked until they invited me to be on the altar guild because I wanted those people in that town to respect me, and I had lost all respect for myself. And that is possibly one of the hardest things I had to forgive me about, that I was politicking up to be on the altar guild. And I asked him, when I was real, real, real new, and I asked to see an Episcopal priest, and because I wanted to tell him what I had done. And he said, well, did you drink from the altar wine? And I said, no, I didn't drink anything after 4 o'clock in the morning, because I wanted to be in shape to get there. He said, well, you know, maybe it helps you, Alabama. Maybe it saved your life that you had something you had that caused you to quit drinking at 4 in the morning. And he asked me would I be willing to talk to the minister of that church, and I said, I don't know where he is, or I would have already called him because I felt so guilty about it. Another thing that helped me have some self-respect and human dignity was that I thought I was different. I guess we all think we're different. We had a few constant women in Missouri that were sober, but I realized that they had not had the background that I had and the rearing that I had had, and I thought I was worse than. And a lady came in from Texas, and she was visiting somebody in the community. And they got her to speak down at the independence group. And she stood up and she said that she had done the same things I had done. I innovated that she had done the same things that I had done. And she stood there beautifully groomed with every inch the lady. And I thought, God, if she can forgive herself, so can I. So can I. So it was, I don't even know who she was, but I just know how important it was for me to find a role model, to find someone who had been where I had been that was walking in such great dignity as she was. She was a beautiful woman. I couldn't possibly tell all my story in the time I have now. See what time it is now. Because I'm 73 years old in this past April, I drank for 23 years until I was 39 years old. I've been sober, you know, nearly 34 years now. So I reason I tell you that, I don't want to just be distracted during the talk and try to add it all up. I used to sit there and hear it, you know, with the people. And I sort of think I should tell you I was 74 because they didn't expect me to live. 73, I'm not 74 yet. That's all right, doesn't really matter. I just live Thanksgiving most. I have been going at a fast pace ever since I was born. I started drinking when I was 16. I went to a party, a Sunday night party, for girls only in my day and time. We did not have the mixed group at the Sunday night party. And some of the boys, you know, a couple of them had been to college already for a year. And they had some, they told me it was wine, but turned out to be, you know, very strong rum. 156% or whatever rum is. I don't like rum. Never did like it since that night. But I liked the way it made me feel. And they told tiny little bits to each of the girls. And I'm the youngest kid on the block. The youngest one day. I had graduated several years ahead of the girls in my age. And they were all 18 or better, and I was 16, and I didn't want them to think I was a kid. So I asked the men to pour me a little bit larger drink that I was accustomed to. And I drank it, and I got drunk. And I took everybody's inventory. And it came in real handy when I got sober. And, you know, I just remembered what I had told them, and you know, and told them that they were phoning, you know, and all of that character defects and so forth. And all I had to do was just remember what I'd said and add some more to it. And I don't know about you, but when I went home from the Sunday night party the next morning, Mother asked me what we did. And I said, Mama, I don't know what the rest of them did. And I laughingly said, I got drunk. And I shrugged my shoulders, and Mother said, honey, you mustn't ever talk like that. People don't believe you sometimes. But I learned in my family, if you would tell the truth, the punishment was never so great. And I started lying then. Now, I hear people come into AA and say they are not lies, that they were not a lie. I don't see how you kept I don't see how you kept a husband or a wife without wine. I am certain that his mind had known if he would left. He would have to leave anyhow, except he died. It's the only way. I didn't like to lie because I was taught to tell the truth. I was taught to tell the truth. And I didn't like lying, but I found out it wasn't socially acceptable to tell the truth. You know, if the truth was what I had done. And I liked it. I liked the taste of it, not rum. I liked the taste of white lightning. I drank it, you know, until prohibition was over. And then I started drinking the bottle and bond stuff. I didn't have any real problem with it until I was around 19. And I started going out with a man that was a number of years my senior, a man that I loved, that I eventually married. And I didn't drink in the morning unless it had been a weekend party that I was drinking with people. I didn't drink alone at that time. But when I went out with this group of very sophisticated people, and people who drank like ladies and gentlemen, I tried to keep up with them, and they had practice more than I did. But I found out that you could get over being sick and start right over again drinking. And I learned how to do that. And I drank pretty heavy. And I remember going to a party my husband-to-be was manager of a gold mine. And I've been called a gold digger, and I'm not a bit thing to send you there. I like Joe. And I like him. He's the only man I've ever wanted to marry in my life. He's the most attractive man I've ever known in my life. And I wanted to be married to him, and he invited his staff, and he invited me for dinner. And we were sitting in front of this fireplace, and my back is to the fire. And I've been drinking pretty heavy with the grief all afternoon. And I know what I'm going to fall in my place. And you ever get that feeling? And I knew that my face was going to be in the place in just a minute. And so as I started falling, I reached up here and said, "Oh, my heart." A couple of engineers, I thought they helped me and said, "Well, let's get it up. You know, call the doctor and so forth and so on." And so I said, "No, we'll just pick up and take the bedroom and continue with dinner." I heard it all, but it wasn't a thing I could do about it. And on the way home, that man told me that he couldn't marry me if I continued drinking like that. That he was going places that I couldn't follow. And he was already in management in his profession and doing very, very well. And I told him that was his problem. Now, he was the only man I've ever wanted to marry, you understand. And I'm telling him it's his problem. And he came back that same night as he left me at the house and apologized for what he had said. And I've often wondered, could I have stopped then? I don't think so. I don't think so. I think I would have cried. But I didn't have to cry because we were married. When I was about 22. And we had I was born in a small country town of 400 people. My family founded the town. They bought it with it from the Indians. And as a young sick girl, I thought that they overpaid them with the bees. And I look back now and I'm real proud of my heritage. And I'm real proud for this. Having been raised in the country, I had relatives that lived in the city. So I had the best of two lives. And there were seven of us. My father drank. One day he decided to quit, and he just quit. I think maybe that he was a periodic alcoholic. I don't really know, but I do not believe that that is the reason I am an alcoholic. I think I got here because I drank too much. And I have believed that ever since I got here. I don't think that I think that I had a lot of problems, but I don't think they were so deep-seated. They were so bright they couldn't take care of them. And I've been very grateful for that because I've seen people who did have such deep-seated problems that for years and years of sobriety, they, you know, still in with the psychiatrist and so forth. And I'm real grateful that this program gave me what I needed. But in the going along with this, I married this man, and I love the traveling. I love living out in the country at the ninth. And then he also did consulting with this company. And sometimes he'd just go ahead and speak to the building of the mills and the method of that they were going to mine and so forth. And we didn't always live on the properties because we would live in hotels. And I just had the best things in life. Just the very best things in life. I was the company hostess. And it allowed me a lot of expense money to entertain and to buy the best of all the liquors and so forth. I had a chauffeur, but I tell you, that wasn't for status signal. My husband liked for me to get home with the car. And everything was going good, except I drink so much sometimes. But I haven't made any scenes where it was real important, you know, for a while there. And I'll just tell you very briefly, we traveled a great deal. I was invited in Richmond to San Francisco or to New York to the stockholders meetings. And I was entertained by the men that had stock in the company. And they all, many of them, owned yachts and belonged to the yacht clubs out of New York. And I liked it. I liked it. Yeah, a country girl born in a little town of 400 we had a lot of land, but it was depression time when I grew up. And not any money, but a lot of land, you know. And but South Texas, all seven of us were educated to the ability that we would take. We said that we could get as many degrees as we wanted, that we were on our own after that. I took two because I didn't know what I wanted to be when I grew up. You know, I didn't know until after I was 40 what I really wanted to be. Everything went well, and I made a good hostess for the company. I met people that I'd only read about in Wall Street journals, and I remember that when I was 22, I was entertaining Wendell Wilson, and you know, and I really was so proud to know these people and to hear how they had, many of them had, had made it without any backing, financial backing and so forth. In fact, quite a few of them were tenant farmers. And they were such wonderful people that I really enjoyed them. Some of them, you know, diamonds in Africa, and just charming people. And everything went pretty good company-wise. Until one night I had a little bit too much to drink. I planned the party, and it's a nice party at one of the better clubs in North Carolina, and I'm sitting to the right of the chairman of the board, and I never have watched him, but always been respectful to him, and so forth and so on. And I told him a silly little joke about the devaluation of the American dollar. And that man said to me that everybody, all the stockholders sitting there at the table, and the people around us, that everybody could hear him. He said, "Evelyn, that's my real name, I didn't know you had communistic ideas." But you don't say that to a drunken rebel. My husband had never heard me swear, but I stood up so the people all around could hear. And I pointed my finger at the chairman of the board so everybody would know who I was talking to. And I called him a son of a bitch. And my husband stood up and I said, "Sit down here, damn Yankee, too." I never knew that he stood up to protect me of the chairman of the board. My husband had never heard me swear because it wasn't allowed in our home. I used those words once. My brother told me I reneged at old maid, and I didn't know what that reneging meant. And I had heard the men driving the cattle call the cattle, "Son of a bitch, get in there." And I thought that was swearing, so I pulled back at my brother. And my brother told my mother, and she washed my mouth out with live soap. So, you know, I just didn't do any swearing in my life, but that night I did. But I didn't stop it there. Everybody at the table was against it. I forgot to tell you that. All of the stockholders. And I didn't stop it, just calling him the son of a bitch. I told him that my family was making this a safe democracy when this family was trying to get courage together. And it was cheap. And you know, that caused me real. On the way home, my husband said I called him everything but a sharecropper and a Christian. I don't remember all of it. Thank God. On the way home, I told my husband that he said he was going to resign the next morning. But my husband was a 20 years my senior, and he's sick for life with this stuff. And I said, "No way. I'm going to leave you because it's my fault, and I'm going to leave you. I'm going to let you resign." And he couldn't go to sleep because I insisted he pull out the trunk for me to pack. I knew I had to get it done while I had the whiskey in me because I wouldn't be able to function the next morning. And he tried to get me to come to bed and couldn't, but he finally just pulled the steamer truck up to the closet. And he lay there in bed watching me, and he said every time, I call myself folding the clothes and packing, but what I actually was doing, I was wadding the clothes up. And as I tried to put them down in the steamer trunk, I'd fall in on top of them. Because I continued to drink the rest of the dinner party. You know, and I'm awfully drunk. I called someone that my husband respected a consultant with the company that was older than George, and that he really respected him, and I told him what I'd done. And he said, "Alabama, it's today I'm saying you had to be dropped to do it." He says, "I've wanted to do it ever since I've known him." And he said not to make a move. But I told you what happened. They never had anything but stag parties in that company until my husband died. Because they couldn't insult him by not including his wife. So that's just one of the things that I did. Again, my husband died a year and a week, about a year before I quit drinking. Died very suddenly of a heart attack. I was fortunately sober, taking anabuse. And I asked my friends, a couple of my close friends, to see that I took the anabuse, you know, about 2 days before the funeral. And I was grateful that I was on it. The doctors had told me that, if I drank on top of it, it could make me so sick it could kill me. So sick that I couldn't drink, and they alive. I drank on top of it, I think, 5 times. But I waited until after the funeral to drink on top of it this time. I had been in a coma once. It didn't kill me, you know, but I'd been in a coma once from drinking on top of it. They told you to wait 2 weeks. And how in the hell do you know in 2 weeks hence what I'm going to need to drink or not? I never did understand their logic. And I drank on top of it, and that last year of my drinking was a very, very worse drinking. I've been in a lot of hospitals that didn't take alcohol. I got to the point that I could give you symptoms with sinus. People in hospitals like to talk. And if I saw somebody brought in by ambulance, you know, and on a stretcher, and they got well enough, I wanted to know all the details. Because the hospital wasn't quite sure, you know, when I called. And I could give them such good details of something that's cute that they would send an ambulance for me. You know, and I've had some surgeries that I don't even know if they were necessary or not. But they have over-described their pain. I'm not certain. But anyhow, I've been in a lot of hospitals that didn't take the alcoholics, treated for something else. A lot of them that knew what they were doing, but they did not write alcohol on the chart. I have been in John's Hospital in Santa Monica twice, and been in psycho there, and had a psychiatrist, and all the kind of internists in that area of town. I had been in Showers Dry. That was one of those little drying out places that had the great paraldehyde, and they gave up us and down us and so forth, and they tried to give me pills. And I said to the doctor that I didn't take pills, and I wouldn't take one, and he says, "How do you get sober?" And I said, "The only way. I taper off with alcohol." And this doctor said he give me an ounce every trial. And if you know that you could go in convulsions and disease and die. You know, with just an ounce every 6 hours if you've been drinking like I have. Now, I've never had convulsions. Never had, but you don't know when you're going to get them. And so I had to arrange things. I had to arrange things like that. A man came in and asked, this was in California, I'd been shipped over by plane from Boulder City, because I'd been in the Boulder City in the Las Vegas hotel, but didn't look good for my husband. And so he sent me to this dry, and the fellow came in, he was sober, and hadn't been sober too long, he wanted to sober up the war. And he asked the doctor to come the next Tuesday, could he take us to the North Hollywood group, to the beginner's meeting, and just raise our hands if we wanted to go. And I raised my hand, and I decided then that I must get out of there and get me a bottle. This being doctor can let me die. And I decided I didn't have much clothes with me to go to an AA meeting. So I called Las Vegas and had the shop that I did business with, called the manufacturers, and asked them to send me an understated navy blue suit to wear. And I said I had my navy blue hat with a little veil and and there would be blue accessories and the white girls and pearls here. So you just took out a seat from the way. I didn't tell her that I took out a friend to a very important meeting. And I didn't tell her it was Alcoholics Anonymous. And in route, I asked them to stop. And the man didn't want to stop. And so it was the Christian story I wanted to stop. And he said that, and I said, well, just put me out. Just put me out. I'll get taxi back. I'm going to get a bottle. And he said, well, I'm not going to buy you a bottle. And I said, well, I didn't ask you to. I just asked you to stop and let me get out and get a bottle. And he said, I know the doctor took all of your money. And I said, are you a fool? Nobody ever takes all of my money. And he said, well, the doctor, he got up your pocketbook, he blindfolded me. And I said, certainly. But I took out what I wanted and needed first. And he said, well, I don't see how you did it. And I said, simple enough. I put it in my bra. I said, I also carry bottles there. That's the reason I wear a lot of soles and a lot of coats. I got in the head that I still wear them, even though I don't have to carry anything there now. And so he stopped, and I got two bottles, one for the meeting, one for the when I get back to the hospital. And some things happened at that meeting there. That's my home group. And I hope you think you got belong to the finest group in the world. But I'm not thinking Williams now. If you don't, for God's sake, don't go somewhere else and laugh at that. Stay with what you got. Stay with what you got and make it better. So I think North Hollywood group was the finest group in the world. But that night, they just explained strange things. They had all these things on the wall, you know, like easy death. Well, I knew easy never did anything. I've done things the hard way. And then first things first, and God, I stopped. I knew that meant you had to get the bottle before you could drink it. And that's what that meant to me that night. And but for the grace of God, and I thought, oh my goodness, we're going to have hellfire damnation here. And I had been, you know, in small towns, incidentally, I'm an Episcopalian now. In small towns, you know, we heard a lot of hellfire damnations in the pit meetings. And then it said, think, think, think. I don't think that should be inappropriate. Now, the pastor told me it did not apply to me. To let him do the thinking until I was able to think. And I must tell y'all right now, this wasn't many women sober. This wasn't many women sober in Independence, Missouri. And I had four men sponsors. And they had four lovely wives who made the call with them. And they took care of me when I didn't even want to be taken care of. And they saw that the other men left me alone, too. And they were swell guys, just swell guys. But in him, my sponsor told me, my spiritual sponsor told me, think, think, think. Would come later in my sobriety. But all he wanted me to think about is that first drink would make me drunk. And not to take that first drink. And a man got up and said he had been in Lincoln Heights. And people laughed. And I thought maybe it was a club with a men in L.A. that I didn't know about. But place to me, and he said, no, it's the big jail facility. And I thought, oh my God, if I'd been in jail, I certainly wouldn't talk about it. And I wondered what kind of opinion he'd had and all those things. And then, y'all, a man got up. And to over 200 people, said that he had been in a several penitentiaries. And I was so ashamed of him. I was so ashamed that he would tell that to a group. And I just got ashamed that somebody hadn't told him better. And I think I'm going to have to skip a lot of 74 years past here in my life. I will tell you this, that I married a man when 3.5 years later, 2.5 years sober, that had been in a federal penitentiary. A fifth of a man. I was married until he was killed 1 year and 1 week later that he had the IQ of a genius.
I knew it was smart, but I never had any trouble keeping up with him, you know. And he's just one wonderful man. We had a great deal in common with him, just a great man. And we got him prison for doing the same things I did. He wrote very bad checks. And his wife found him objectionable, and she told me after he died, she never loved anybody but him. But she just couldn't be responsible for him check. And his mother went bankrupt trying to keep him out of trouble. And he didn't have to stay very long because I think they made some concessions because he was going to that Alcoholics Anonymous in prison and had a very, very good attorney that made an appeal too. Well, I don't think big bad checks, and my husband's lifetime, he covered them. And then after he died, my family covered them. I had four brothers and a father that covered my checks. And then the Al-Anon got him to my brother and told him they were enabling me to stay drunk. And told him that as long as they would cover my checks, that I just keep writing them, and they said that they really were keeping me from getting sober. They were enablers. And do you know my family quit covering my checks? And I'd love to tell it, and it isn't exactly true. At least I'm not sure if it is. But I told the women after I got sober in Al-Anon, they called family group there, that some of their husbands covered the rest of them until I got sober. Yeah, I'm not quite sure that that was all the truth or not. It wasn't their husbands, but it would get the fly. My kids got sober. And I don't take for over $1,000. I just walked off Astoria, took for over $1,000, and told them it was that I didn't have the money in the bank. They asked me, well, when I cover it, and I said, yes, when I'm able to travel and go home. I give you my word of honor, I was in the blackout in New York that last season. I don't remember being in the Waldorf. I'm saying it's pure peace. You know, I don't remember it. I don't remember it at all. I've been back since then, and I remember the Waldorf because I've stayed there before, but I don't have any recall that year. And my brother took the check, all of my checks. But they called my brother, and he said, well, why are you calling me? And he said, because you represented my company. And he said, I wish you would know right now she doesn't represent me or the company. You know. And he said, well, would she cover the checks? And he said, what did she say? And he said, Robinson, she said that when she was able to travel, she'd go home, and she could find the key to the vault, that she, and when she felt like it, she'd go and see if she had the most socks or something she could sell, and she'd cover it. And he said, I wouldn't say to a man of your caliber, but she said we could do it. She didn't like it. You know, but Dr. Paul O said that he thinks that I had a blackout that went into amnesia. You know, that some of them went into amnesia. I was reading to, I was talking to a man that I was having dinner with, and he said we'd better hurry, and we were having a nice lunch, I thought, you know, a lot of drinks with it and everything. And I said, what's our hurry? And he said, we don't want to be late. We don't want to miss our plane. I don't know where we're going. And just followed the time, I said, well, couldn't we take a later one? And he said, no, that would make us too late to get our license in Miami to get married when we play in it. I couldn't remember his name. I remember where I met him, but I couldn't remember his name. And we had called a lady in Alabama, and she knew his family. Old Southern family, Episcopalian, owned a hotel on Miami Beach. Just first-class people, she said. And I don't know the man's name. And I said, well, you're right, and I got a lot of packing here. If you will excuse me, I think I would just leave and call a cab and stop packing because it's not going to take you as long to pack as it does me. And I asked the cab driver to take me as far out of a race from that hotel as he possibly could. Without going into Oakland, because I wanted to escape that man. I had gone to Connecticut to meet a man who wanted to marry me to introduce me to the family. But he took a bottle of Oakland, and I see a Coke bottle across the rim in front of his yellow mother. you know, it tried to hit him in the head with it and kill him, but it didn't work. And that's the reason I'm in New York. That didn't work out too well. But, you know, we didn't have a thing in common except baseball, and I knew the season was too short. I got his friends like me, and they liked me when I first got there, and his mother said I was a lovely Southern belle. Well, I want to tell you the belle had quit shining when I left. I had to ask that somebody drive me to New York after I see that. You know, I didn't wait for them to ask me to leave. I was in the hospital in New York that time. The doctor put me in Knickerbocker alcoholic wing. That was the old town's hospital that had been moved over. And pretty the red-headed nurse was there, and people came from the inner group to call on me as they were supposed to be. And you know, I didn't take a drink until after I had dinner with the person the doctor had called to sponsor me. And I went to the meeting with her because I thought it was only common courtesy to go to a meeting with somebody that had gotten her in the hospital. And I was to a meeting off and on for a solid year without any desire to quit drinking. I don't know why I went to the meeting. But I wanted to want to quit. And folks, it didn't get it for me. It just didn't forget it. My brother had me met at an airport. My nephew met me as I fell down the, you know, didn't have the covered ramps in those days. You had to get off on the pier. As I fell down, the nation doctor had me wheeled out in a wheelchair, and they were afraid they couldn't get me on, so they talked to my brother, and he said, "Well, what you do, you buy a pier, and you wrap it in a paper sack. And when you get there, you know, walk ahead of them, put it on the seat you sit on, and I guarantee you can make those steps." And my nephew met me and took me to Pennsylvania, Missouri. I wouldn't stop because they said, "Dr., give me a drink on the way. I'd already be drunk. They knew when I arrived." And took me to my brother's offices, and they said that they were going to have to ask mother and daddy to have me incarcerated and declared incapable of managing my own affairs. And I told them something about my business affairs, and you know, they were cute businessmen, and they couldn't handle them. And they told me they didn't want me in their homes anymore because they didn't want their children to see their aunt drunk. That they seemingly knew I was sick, and let's keep it that way. And they said I embarrassed their wife when I went to place the same social events that they did, and to please not do that to their wife. And they told me they loved me, but that something was just going to have to be done. Something was going to have to be done. Very shortly thereafter, I had breast surgery. And you know, I knew if it was malignant, that it was self-inflicted. And I've had three to be exact, and each time I think, all right, the Bible could have done it. But anyhow, what happened was that it wasn't malignant. And they kept me there to build me up so I wouldn't ever have to drink again. God, how many times I had been built up so I would never have to drink again. And what happened was that I went home believing that I would not drink again. The doctor told my brother that I wasn't going to die of cancer, that I was going to die of alcoholism. And I fully intended not to ever take another drink. The first time I had ever promised me I wouldn't. I don't think I need to have to tell you that when I got home, and in that apartment by myself and with my own thoughts, after having been with people for three solid weeks there, and I had not had anything brought into the hospital, nothing, because I was so sure I could stay sober. I'd always believed when I was ready to quit I could. But you know, I ordered a case of whiskey the first night I was at home, and I wasn't expecting company. And I thought I'd drink until I died, until I had all I wanted to drink, until my family had me incarcerated. I knew I was going to have to do something. Something happened. And none of those things happened. Obviously, I didn't die. I was born again, though, and I'll tell you about in a few minutes. And I wasn't incarcerated. Instead, I was freed from the bondage of alcohol and self. Well, partially self, since I've been in AA. And it's just a miracle. It's just a miracle. I drank. I didn't call anybody for help. They said that they saw no signs of my having eaten any food. They had stocked my refrigerator before I came home. Saw no signs of any food having been cooked or taken off of there in the apartment. There's an empty bottle in the bed with me. I just went to bed and drank. And a woman called me, I think at the end of the fifth day. And she asked me, could she come and see me? And I said, of course not. I'm getting dressed to go to work. Now, folks, I worked for my brothers after my husband died for a very short. They built an office on for me. So, you know, they thought if they could keep me busy, maybe I wouldn't drink so much. But I hadn't been in that place of business, the office, in 6 months. But I am trying to get dressed to go to work. And I told her that that didn't need to be detained. And she shouldn't. She wouldn't make me late to work. I found out later that it was 7 o'clock in night that I was dressing to go to work. But it was wintertime, and you couldn't tell by looking out the window. And this woman came over, and she took me to her home. And people like you came. And I told you that there were very few alcoholic women back in the, except in the larger cities then in that part of the country. And this woman begged me until I went home with her. And she called people. And the wife of the alcoholic came with their husband. And they took turns sitting with me through the night. And I watched your faces. And I saw what I see on your faces tonight. And I lay there all night long trying to think what that look was that I saw in your eyes. I knew that my countenance had looked like that at one time. And I knew I didn't look that way anymore. I didn't know me when I looked in the mirror anymore. And now, of course, I know now that it's self-respect and human dignity that you had, purpose in living, and all of the good things that count. And I was bored of them. And you know, it's like being dead. It's just like being dead. And the next morning, the people took care of my needs, lifted me out of the bed when it was necessary, and put me in the tub, and change the sheets, you know, those kind of things you do for drugs. And the next morning when Earl and his wife came over, Earl being my Sedalia, Missouri sponsor, I said, I will forget sober, but Earl, I think I'm going to die this time. And this wasn't melodrama. I really thought so, and Earl said, honey, I know, you're a very, very sick woman. And he said, we're trying to find a place to put you there. It was no place to take an alcoholic woman around there. They couldn't get me back to New York because the claims were not running. And they could get me back to California or someplace. And because all the airports were shut down, they had Kansas City and around. And there were so few places that you could take an alcoholic woman. And Earl called a man named Walt in Independence, Missouri, and said, Walt, told Walt about me. And he said, she's going to die without help. And we thought that Dr. Nason, these men are dead now, it's all right. You know who I'm talking about, right? That Dr. Nason could help me. And all four of my men sponsors died sober, incidentally, and were four of the nicest men I've ever known in my life. And they took me in a snowstorm, and they stopped it in traffic, and they told them they had to get through with me. And I was hallucinating, smelling magnolias with the snow on the ground on the way up. The men had to take me in head first, and they took me back upstairs over an empty store. Now remember, I'm just out of the Waldorf and the Pierre. They took me over an empty store upstairs, close to the courthouse, the nearest thing they got in Independence, Missouri, to Skid Row. Back of a little dirty club room that had no shades at the windows, no rugs on the floor, and the old sofas, you know, and the winos laying down on the sofas there. And back of that, they had rooms for men, where the men in the AA detoxifies their brothers. And Walt told them they didn't take women because they had no women to take care of them. But he said, Earl said, but she's going to die. Walt, she is going to die without help.
And Walt said, put her on the phone, and he told me what kind of place I was coming to. And I said, Walt, I want to get sober more than I've ever wanted anything in my life, because I think I'm going to die, and I want to die sober. And Walt said, tell them to bring you. And they took me in there and had to lift me up those steps. And I found out later it was 12 steps to recovery that they were taking me up. And it actually was 12 steps. Because my first baby counted them as they were bringing her up. They got where they would take the women in too. Now, you didn't pay to go there. These are just men in AA that cared enough to detoxify their brothers. And they did it, you know, with a little whiskey every once in a while and some Burrell behind if it got bad. And they'd call a doctor in, you know, if your pulse rate became too high and so forth. And I'd love to tell you that everything just went well, but it didn't. I went insane. Nobody could handle it except Walt. Walt had been just like me. They had found him in a jail in Kansas City, Kansas, trying to kill himself in his cell and praying for God that he could quit drinking, and then trying to kill himself. And this black man that heard him, this janitor, went to the judge, and Walt's wife was in talking to the judge about committing Walt. And he said, asked if he might see the judge, and the judge saw him privately. And he said, that man in there ain't crazy. He's an alcoholic. And there's a doctor named Nathan here in town that knows what to do for him, because he's sober. And he's got friends that would help him. And he said, let me call him and let him come and see Walt. You know. And the judge turned Walt over to Dr. Nathan, and they took him to the basement of the doctor's home. And people from AA in Kansas City, Kansas, took care of this insane man. He was in the same maniacal condition that I was in. They called Dr. Nathan, and he came in the snowstorm. He came twice a day, because there was not another doctor in that part of the country anywhere nearer than Ashland, New York, California, that knew what to do with an alcoholic in that condition. But the doctor there in town had been giving me, was making me worse. And Dr. Nathan made the trip every day. But Walt would have to tell him over and over, me over and over and over, that this is the man that saved his life, and he loved this man. And would I please let the man do for me? The way for the women could not take care of me, because it was dangerous. When you're in a maniacal condition like that, the doctor told Walt I could kill a man twice my size with my bare hands. Walt prayed aloud. This man sat in a reclining chair 5 days and nights with an insane woman. Now, I don't know if you've ever done that or not, but I tried a day and night, and I couldn't make it the full 24 hours. And I had to call for help. And they finally had to have her put in the state mental department. You know, in California. I just didn't have the spiritual courage, I guess, to go through with it any longer. And I tried. And Walt prayed. My family prayed. AA groups that didn't know me prayed that I would be restored to sanity and the obsession to drink would be removed. And at the end of 5 days, Walt told me that when the doctor left, that the doctor said the prognosis was very bad. And he said, Alabama, we got to do something. And he said, the doctor's done everything that medical science knows to do. He could put you in the hospital over there right now, but he'd have to put you in restraint, because he can't take you in that condition without it. And he said that we thought you'd be better off here. And he said, but the doctor says that medicine doesn't know anything else to do for you. And your family has prayed, and all these groups are praying. He said, I prayed every day. And he said, Walt, what can I do? He said, I've had to do something. He said, could you pretend that God was polite, and that he doesn't come where he's uninvited by the host? And I said, I think so. And he said, well, you ask him to remove the obsession for you to drink. and to restore you to sanity on a lifetime basis, a day at a time. And I said, well, you know I can't remember that much. And Walt said, I know, honey. Just ask God to let you mean what you're going to repeat. And word for word, I repeated that prayer after Walt. And in that dirty bathroom that salesmen and I were using to get supper in, I heard God say to me, don't be frightened to peek in there, you wouldn't hurt a thing. But I heard God say to me that I could be sober and I could be sane on a lifetime basis, a day at a time. And folks, that wasn't even the miracle. The miracle was I believed it. I believed it then, and I have believed it every waking moment since, that I can be sober and I can be sane on a lifetime basis, a day at a time. I ran out in the hall telling them what happened, and they ran and got Walt and said, she's gone totally insane. And I even knew then by this time what they're saying. And he said, oh no, oh no. On the contrary, this is possibly the sanest she's ever been in her adult life. And day by day, I started getting better. And they let me go down there. And we took another woman in. And they told me a cot in, and I slept in the room with her. And my family was going to get a nurse to come home with me and all those things. And they said, please don't. Please don't. But we've got to find some place for her to be, but let her stay close to us. She's awfully sick, yes. And they called my brothers, and they said what had happened was that there were so few women in AA, and the wives of the alcoholics, they had just been all the time away from home they could, and that they were afraid that my family would not want them to stay up there with a house full of men. You know, there had been a woman sitting outside in the living room of the meeting room every night, every evening, and the women came and took turns doing it just for the looks of things, and they said they would keep me there except for that. And that they, people were just worn out, the few volunteers they had. And my brother said, we trusted you with our sister when she was drunk. And you saved her life. We certainly can trust our sister with you when she's sober. And he said, if you all would keep her, if you all would keep her, we would all be mighty proud. And they kept me there with those men. And they loved me back to self-respect and human dignity. There was a man named John Brooks out of Kansas City, Kansas. And John told me what a wonderful lady I was. And he brought his wife to say, isn't she pretty? And that's what John and his wife gave to me. They made me feel that I was a lady. They introduced me one time, he did, when I was speaking. And I'm going back to Wichita and speak pretty soon. And John, that's the last time John introduced me with this convention in Wichita. And he told them what a beautiful lady I was, drunk or sober. And you know, when people tell you how pretty you are, and that you are a beautiful lady, you want to become one. You want to become one. And I contradicted him once, and he said, I saw her when she was very, very sick, and she was still a lady. She was just a little insane. And so John and his wife gave me a lot of human dignity. The doctor saved my life medically, and he also started for free giving me all kinds of vitamin shots. And I had terrible migraine headaches when I was drinking, and the doctor told me the time was going to come when I wouldn't have any more migraine headaches, and that my family, my sponsor told my family not to send me a penny of money for one solid year. They said, well, we're going to send y'all some money for keeping, and he said, no, 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 she gets sober, she'll give what she can, she'll give what she can. Don't give her one penny of money for a year, because if she remains a parasite, and then you might stay beside her. You might stay one in too good a shape. I was the kind of drunk, if I was in a dry state and couldn't find a bootlegger in a hurry, I would charter a plane. You know, and I thought anybody would that had the money, you know. And you know, when you checked in two hotels and owed the Waldorf over $1,000, and don't even remember being there, and you're in the hospital part of that time, you know, all of those things. I spent a lot of money. But what I found out was that my husband had become a chronic gambler, and we had lived 3 years in Nevada. And I thought he gambled like I did, lose 50 or so, or get to make 50 or 100 or something. But my obsession was drinking. I'd sit down and play cards for a little while, but never to take over him. And I'd play a little blackjack, but it didn't keep my interest long, because I wanted to be out there amongst those people that were drinking. And because they just fed me drinks, that I, you know, I could sit at any table in the house without playing, and they'd never ask me to move with the line back up me. They'd never ask me. Of course, I understood it all when I got sober and found out how many thousands and thousands of dollars, you know, that these casinos had about them. I did crazy things, like I got up on stage. I never did ask George whether they asked me to come up or not. But with Dean Martin and his partner, it was the first time they appeared. It was at a private hotel party. And I was up on the stage, and you know, I embarrassed my husband by doing those things. But in here, they told me, my brother got me a job. He said I had to work. So my brother got me a job at the state of Missouri, at the Capitol. And my sponsors wouldn't let me take it, and I said, why? And they said, because we're taxpayers. We don't want our money wasted. I wouldn't get a job. After I got well enough, they thought to be job hunting. And you know what happened? My sponsor went out and got me a job. Clicking in a drugstore, a big one, where they sold everything. But you had to be a salesperson there. You know, people didn't go around with the car. And Kent's Drug Company for 76 cents an hour. I bet. And do you know what my sponsor said? That I ought to pay those people to teach me to work. But they said. My family didn't send me any money. My brother brought me a stack of bills this high. And he told me that he thought I should write every creditor and tell them that I had been ill, but that I would take care of this when my state was settled. But in the meantime, as soon as I was able to go to work, I was going to send them token payments to show that I wanted to pay my bill. And I said, well, what shall I tell them I've been suffering from if I've been ill so long? And he said, why don't you try alcoholism? And I wrote these letters. And I would like to tell you, I finished paying the bill about 5 years thereafter. And when my fate was settled, but I never failed to send the token money, I promise. And my credit was not hurt one particle. Not one particle. Every one of those people and those that I saw in person. And when I go back to Missouri and go to the country clubs and everything, they'll come over and whisper, I've never known a woman like you. And see, it wasn't me. It was my brother and you in the AA and this program that was telling me how to conduct myself. I made a mistake or two. We call them sugar daddies in Alabama. And there was one that came along, and he thought I was too nice to go to work. And a nice lady like me shouldn't have you, and he had plenty of money for both of us. I nearly got drunk, folks, because I didn't talk this over with my sponsors. And I nearly got drunk, and I started praying that God wouldn't let me get drunk. And I knew that that was worse than, in my opinion, than anything I'd ever done drunk. He had a wife. I met her and liked her better than I did him. But, you know, he was just going to make things, it just seemed to be such a nice man. Remember, I'm still ding-a-ling. I'm not trying to excuse myself, but I'm glad I learned early on the program. Because I think it's the same thing that happened to me after I'd been sober longer. I might have gotten drunk. But I did forgive myself. And I didn't talk to my sponsors about it because I didn't feel that I had a right to tell these people. I went to a minister and talked to him about it. And I prayed, and I didn't have a good feeling at all. And I had the most wonderful thing happened after laying awake. And I don't know whether I just gone to sleep or what. but I remember the telling of something that happened, either the incident or the telling of something that happened when I was a child. It said that I ran down 14 steps off of our back porch, and before Mother and Daddy got to me, I was running in the path of the cows that the black men were driving in from the pasture. And the lead cow was a Jersey, and she was very ferocious because she had a calf in there she wanted to get to. And they said I got right in the pathway of where I was coming in, that nobody could reach me in time. And they said I looked at the cow as she started to approach and said, "You better not bother me. I'm Jess Robinson's daughter." And the cow turned and walked away. And the other cow followed the lead. And the men were able to control the situation. And I thought, oh God, how great it is. All I've got to do is to know that you are my heavenly Father and love you like I love my earthly father. Love you like I love my dad. And let it be known that I'm your daughter, just as I told the cow. And do you know, everything was all right. Everything was all right after that. I'm so grateful for the remembrance of that. And since then, I have trusted God just like I trusted my father. Except, of course, I know that it's the spiritual love and that God, you know, there's nothing he can't do. My father helped me take my inventory because I was incapable. And he had told me to write down my assets, and I said I couldn't think of any. And he said, "Well, I've noticed animals like you. Write it down." And he had me write down my assets, and he helped me with my assets. And he had me write down my liabilities, and I said, "Like what?" And he said, "Like seeds." And I said, "Well, I haven't stolen anything since I was a tiny child. I stole some nickels and dimes off of my father. And mother, you know, when they put the change down." And he said, "Alabama, when you went out with a married man, you're thief." I never had thought of it that way. And all I wanted was an escort. And I tried to explain. I didn't like to go to the places I wanted to go. You had to have an escort. I just borrowed those men. I didn't want them. I justified everything, just all the way down the line, everything. And he said, "Write down a lie." And I said, "Well, I exaggerate sometimes to make it sound better. But I really am not a liar. I'm known for my integrity." Well, said Alabama, "Write down a lie. If you're an alcoholic, you are a liar." And so he let me take my inventory. And then he called an Episcopal priest because he said that I might be sorry someday that I took the part that he didn't take, that if I took it with him, and that he felt that he didn't know any woman really of the that he wanted me to take it with. So how about calling an Episcopal priest that was interested in AA and take it with him? And I did, and I was able to tell about the money I owed the government. You know, and not talking about all that stock I had to sell to pay my debts off, and we bought the stock, you know, right at good bottom, mining stock and everything. And I talked to this minister, and I felt better about it. And he guided me through there. And then I got this job, and they told me I had to work for two years at the same place to have a good recommendation. But working for family or at company hostess where my husband was a manager, that wouldn't do. And I went to work, and I didn't like to go to work, and I told Walt I didn't like to go to work, and he said, "Pretend you like to work, Alabama. And you put a smile on your face every morning, and you ask God to let you keep it on your face, and you be nice to those people." And one day I'm going down the street and singing, and you know I can't carry a tune. And I'm so happy that I have a job and that I'm going to it, that I'm singing about it. And in 7 months sobriety and 5 months of working in the store, they made me manager guy of my department. And then also that first year I won the citation for what I had done with the department and so forth. And Mr. Captain Seth gave it to me. And, you know, those fellas, they damn, and I talk about men. I've always loved men. I've always loved men. But we just didn't have the women in the group to talk to. That, and those men would wait for me until I got in from the store at night. And they started to take Alabama's inventory. It was known as that, and then they told me where I could handle the situation better. And, you know, then the night came when I hadn't been rude to anybody. It felt that I had done very well. And then they asked me what I had to eat that day. And if they felt I hadn't had enough protein, they said to Alabama, you got to eat right so you can keep that job. And if I didn't have enough protein, they said, who has got enough money to pay for the steak and the rest of us will drink coffee? And we'll join this meeting for such and such restaurant. And, you know, this whole table of men would go with me, and they'd tell me what happened at the meetings that I missed. And I said they did it every night to sort of take my inventory, too. But those men loved me, and I know they loved me, and they made me feel like that I was a lovely lady and that I was okay. And it was good to be in that environment where they felt like it. And I'm so grateful. I am so very grateful that they didn't have all these organizations that paid for alcoholics not to work. I am so grateful to God I didn't know that was a softer, supposedly easier way. I am seeing people dying all around me, because they don't go out in this world and go back to work. And they just become parasites, and they have no self-respect and human dignity, and they drink time after time after time. And then they can always go and get some SSI benefits and so forth and so on. I love those kids down at the club, North Hollywood Clubhouse, and I talk to them about it, and I tell them we can't hold our heads high, and we can't stay sober without human dignity and self-respect. And then they say, just go out and get a job no matter what they're doing. Or how little they make that they can walk tall again. I know I'm getting pretty warmed up about that, but I don't like to see alcoholics die. I don't like to, and I am so grateful that my brothers and my family love me enough to do what they told me to do. I've been married, I told you, to Jim, and he died and was killed in an automobile accident. I never had to go through anything alone. There were two men in the group that loved me enough that they sat up all night long talking to me and telling me that if this poor me had gone far enough, it was going to be pour me a drink if I didn't get out there and start working with the other alcoholics again. And the next day, you know, a man just happened to call me. Just happened to call me and asked me, could I take a girl in my house? That she couldn't stay sober with her mother and daddy. And she had a boyfriend that was out there still drinking, and so I actually adopted these two kids and started working with them. Now, Bakersfield is not Hollywood. Bakersfield, California. I walked out in my robe with those two men to the car and kissed them both goodbye at 7 o'clock in the morning. And the neighbors were all looking, and I didn't give a damn. Because they saved my life. They literally saved my life. My dad died 2 months after I was sober. And he was right there with me all the way through it. I've lost a brother and sister from alcoholism. I have a sister that is. But look, my sister would stay sober as long as 2 years. She just couldn't make it beyond that, it seemed. And I have a sister that's sober now. She did it through her church. And I am proud to tell you that I have not interfered with it. And she is as happy as I am happy. And she lives as productive life as I live. And you know, there are other ways for other people, but I like being sober in AA. I love being sober in AA. My brother died. Just an officer and a gentleman. So they didn't put alcoholism. They wrote damn kidney failure. But they didn't write on his death certificate the liver had just deteriorated so from the drinking the kidneys could not handle the poison. You know, and my mother, dear thing that was raised in the South, started telling people that Evelyn, her daughter, was in AA and that she was sober. She told people that they didn't even know I ever had a drinking problem. because she felt that we could not stay quiet about this any longer, because there was a way out. There was a way out. And she came and visited me, and when she went home, she started detoxifying people herself, and she was about 80 then. You know, she learned the secret of detoxification. My family loved the fact that I'm in AA. They love my being sober. And in ending, I'd love to tell you that I have worked these programs to the best of my ability. I've never worked it to the best of my intellectual ability, but I've done the best I could with the emotions combined with the intellect. I was married, I will tell you this, I was married once on this program. And I'm telling you for a reason. AA and sex is not the basis for a good marriage. You have to have more in common than that. I know better now. I've had several other opportunities, and I've just decided I'm old enough to make it alone. I'm old enough to make it alone. The man's sober, married to an Al-Anon, and everything's great. Everything's great. He's going to come to our home group, a mutual home group, and take his 30 he's sober 30 now. This coming week, I believe, when I get on. But I've been through a lot of things since I've been sober. But I've never had to go through any of the joys or any of the sorrows alone. You've always been there. But I started wearing a halo when I was earlier in the program, because I was being invited out to talk. And so we used it as an example. If Alabama can get well, anybody can. You know, it's a horrible example. And then I just had this condemnation that was great, you know, from cats and so forth and so on. This raise in salary. And I went down to the club one night. The men were waiting there for me as usual. They said, come sit down. I said, a cat. I've got to go upstairs and see the poor sick woman. And I was wearing a halo that night. And I don't know whether you've ever seen an alcoholic wear a halo or not. Well, I hope you don't have the displeasure. They're most unbecoming, especially on alcoholics. They turn very readily. And I think that's from the poison left from so much, the toxic poison left from the whiskey. And then they have a way of blinding us, falling down and blinding us. And that's the condition I was in that night when I told these boys that saw me win, that I had to go upstairs and speak to the poor sick lady. And I came down blinded, and I said, oh boy, I am so glad I didn't go the lengths the poor girl upstairs went to before I got here. And Dick Awano said to me, Alabama, what she done, you ain't done. And I said, Dick, she told every one of us today at noon in this club room as they were bringing her in that she just went, poof, the peak. I had to whisper the word. I couldn't say it. And Dick looked at me with Al-Anon like eyes. And he pointed his finger at me and he said, Alabama, ain't you go ever get off. And I said, Dick, I don't even know what you're talking about. He said, I'm talking about self-honesty, Alabama, self-honesty. I said, Dick, I still don't know what you're talking about. And Dick said, Alabama, don't you know the only difference in you and that woman upstairs is that you didn't know you could sell it and decide you didn't need the money. Anytime my ego starts getting in the way today, I just remember how stupid I was. Thank you.